Welcome to the AI and Faith podcast. We are a community of expert technologists, professionals, and faith leaders, bringing the ancient wisdom of the world's major religions to the ethics of artificial intelligence. Join us on this journey and welcome to the conversation.
What does it mean to be human? Could we, by changing the human genome, produce a post-human? I don't think scientifically people take that seriously. Most of the actual experimentation currently is for therapeutic purpose. And I think that virtue ethicists, like Aristotle's notion of eudaimonia and human flourishing, and we know that if you're healthy, you're more likely to flourish than if you're unhealthy. So right now, I'm not too worried about where the field at large is going. But yes, the potential for getting into the human genome and changing genes for some malicious purpose, making the perfect soldier who's a perfect killer, and these kinds of scenarios do worry.
Welcome. My name is Gilad Berenstein, and thank you for joining us for another episode of the AI and Faith podcast. On this podcast, we're bringing together experts from our community and thought leaders from around the world so that together we can learn the key lessons required to build a world where AI benefits humanity and all of us individually. As we all know, AI is being integrated into every element of our lives and world. And over the past months, we have explored many ways that AI has been intersecting into every element of human life and field of study. Today, I'm excited to dive into a topic of human biology, genetics, and bioethics, a topic that is quite complex, but one that many believe is at the next frontier of technology and AI-led innovation. So we have three brilliant guests joining us today to talk about this topic and to help us unpack what's actually going on and what should the rest of us be thinking about. So without any further ado, let's get started. Thank you all for joining us today. It's really wonderful to have you with us. I'm hoping you can begin with quick introductions, who you are, where you are physically, and what you focus on, and just a little bit about yourself as a person of faith, what faith you belong to and how much you practice. And maybe Ted, you can kick us off.
Well, nice to be with you here, Gilad, and I applaud this series of podcasts because we're right on the frontier of technology, biology, and the human future. My name is Ted Peters. I teach at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California, in theology and ethics. And what I have done that brings me here is that during the Human Genome Project, I supervised a National Institutes of Health study on the ethical implications of genomics, and then later with the Geron Corporation on the development of stem cell therapies. And currently, I'm working with Braden, who will be introduced in a few minutes, on the frontier of artificial intelligence. And if anything is going to have an impact on the human future, it's that. So thanks for bringing these fields together, and I look forward to our conversation.
Amazing. Thank you so much for joining us. And Sarah Jo?
Yeah, thank you. And yeah, I second that. Thank you so much for bringing us together. I'm looking forward to this. So I come to this conversation as an ethicist trained in both philosophical and theological ethics, with a particular focus on the philosophy and ethics of technology. What initially drew me to this field of study in graduate school was the work of Hans Jonas. And I'm going to mention him right away because I know I'm going to be channeling Hans Jonas through this. And I want to say right away who he is, so I don't leave anybody out, because I know you all might know, but maybe not all the listeners. So Hans Jonas was a German Jewish philosopher who fled Nazi Germany in the mid 20th century. He was incredibly concerned about what he had seen in his time. And he was a student of Martin Heidegger, who's also a really important philosopher of technology. But Jonas was known for his imperative of responsibility, and also a concern for the future of humanity, and also known in many circles in bioethics for his early essay on his work on ethics of human experimentation. So I wanted to mention that right away because I know I'll be channeling him. But in terms of myself as an ethicist, I'm a Kantian myself, but I also think the moral imagination is incredibly important. In that direction, I had the opportunity to work with computer scientists on pedagogical resources for teaching computer scientists. In that direction, I've been thinking about religious thought, but also science fiction and using different resources for cultivating moral imagination. And finally, in terms of my research interests, my dissertation was on Immanuel Kant, no surprise, but even there and still today, I am looking at trying to retrieve his insights for thinking what it means to be a moral agent in today's technological age. For him, the question was, what does it mean to be a moral agent in a Newtonian universe? But I think for us, it really is what it means to be a human moral agent in a time of technological change.
And our audience is that's an important topic that our audience is well aware of, and trying to think of the question of, you know, what does the new morality look like in a world that AI has been intersecting with so many elements of our lives? So thank you so much for bringing that into it. And we hope to dive into that in a lot more detail. And then Braden.
Yes, thank you very much for the opportunity. I'm looking forward to our discussion. My name is Braden Mulhook. I'm the director of the Center for Theology and the Natural Sciences here at the Graduate Theological Union in Berkeley, California. I teach classes on ethics and theology and science, or science and religion, however you want to conceive of it. My own background, I was a double major in genetics and religion. Got a lot of people asking, how does that work? Is that possible? So these questions have really been central to my formation, you know, throughout my life. So moved on to do master's work in bioethics with religion, and then was sort of directed towards CTNS and the GTU as one of the places in the world to really dig deeper into that. So along the way, picked up various other tools. I mean, bioethics is notoriously deontological, but sort of picked up a virtue bent here at the GTU and have been trying to apply that to issues around gene editing and then also artificial intelligence. I would summarize my work as looking at the relationship between emerging science and technology and what it means to be human and how that's going to change in light of what's happening today.
This is really exciting stuff, and I'm so grateful that all of you have joined us today. So we're going to start it off with the real basics. We're going to have Ted kick us off, and then we'll go around to see what we all have to add. But start us off, what is bioethics? What is that field? And what do people in that field even do all day?
Well, bioethics, if I remember correctly, and Braden can correct me, I think sprung up in the 1970s, and it has an obvious phase, what happens in medical ethics in the hospital or clinical setting. But to take a look at the frontier of biological research, and this became the area in which the bioethicists worked. For the most part, they went to laboratories and watched what the scientists were doing, helped to formulate issues. It's interesting to know that both bioethics and artificial intelligence ethics, that what happens is the practitioners, the researchers, they stand around the water cooler or the coffee pot, and they talk about ethical issues. So it's a partnership between the scientists and the ethicists, and it's a mistake to think that the scientists want to keep the ethicists away. No. The scientists invite the ethicists in for a good conversation. That's my experience.
Incredible. And Sarah Jo or Braden, anything to add?
I would say there's maybe sort of two strains to what I would consider bioethics. And I think Ted's right that medical ethics is sort of the precursor to that. And I think a lot of the development of that really stemmed from post-World War II. We learned a lot of things that happened and how do we make decisions about information that was obtained in really horrific ways. And then even in the United States, the Belmont Report really sort of set forward in terms of bioethics, what do we want to consider when we're looking at research in human subjects. So I would say that the medical ethics end of that is the first iteration. And then this exploring what Ted was saying in terms of ongoing research at the intersection of biological sciences and scientific research in general is maybe a more of a research ethics sort of strain.
Yeah, that makes perfect sense. And Sarah Jo, as you join us on this topic, maybe you can broaden it a little bit. What are some of the other, before we get into AI, some of the other kind of bioethics in addition to medical ethics element of the study?
Well, one thing that just came to my mind was the mapping of the human genome. Of course, that's one thing. But I think now we're asking questions about how AI is used in the medical industry, of course, issues of privacy. And those are the two that come to my mind at first. Yeah.
Absolutely. Perfect. And then let's bring AI into it, and we'll bring you all into the conversation. We'll start with Sarah Jo and go backwards. But as we bring AI into this world, into biology and medicine and everything else, what are a few of the things that you or your colleagues or other people studying the field, what should we be thinking about in the most macro kind of view? What are the key areas of focus?
I think that relationships are a relation to technology, but also with care. And in the medical industry and bioethics, I think it's this need for care of patients and those that need to rely on others. And I think there's this tendency to want to help them, but at the same time, offload some of our responsibility and work that we have to do, the labor. And I think we just have to ask, like, what can AI do for us as an entity that we might have to have a sort of relationship with? And I think that these questions are becoming more and more important. I mean, you open up your apps for a meditation or something, and you're being asked to talk to a therapist, an AI therapist,
yeah.
and you're kind of encouraged to engage in this. And I think there's a lot of good that can come out of that. But also, I think that we should just step back and say, okay, what are relationships with this? And where do we stop and where do they begin?
Yeah, absolutely. And Braden, journalism conversation here. Where is AI coming to this field? What should we be thinking about? What are some of your colleagues thinking about?
Yeah, it's really, people could go in a million directions with it. So I'll try and pick out a few here. And I think one, I'm going to hold up a good example. I want to talk about maybe AlphaFold for a second, that, you know, here's AI assisting scientists in basic research. They were trying to figure out the structure of proteins. How do these molecules come together and fold in a way that create all these really useful things for us? And AI really pushed forward some of that study by being able to brute force through some things and identify patterns that humans were struggling to do. So I don't want to say that the future is all bleak, because I think what I'm going to say now is that there are lots of ways in which AI can also be of concern. So Sarah Jo was just talking about wanting to offload things or to were overworked. And so there are ways in which, particularly in radiology, and then I was also saying like gerontology, that AI is already trying to be used. And there are ways in which that can be helpful, but I still would want to see humans in the loop. But as we have an aging population, AI is also sort of being tasked as a potential caretaker for people who are older. And I worry about that because we've already mentioned therapy, but there are instances where chatbots are encouraging people to do destructive things.
Oh, nice.
People are falling in love with entities that aren't actually conscious. And so if we put vulnerable people in direct contact with these types of technologies on a daily basis, I think there are going to be a lot of consequences to that.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ted, what's your thought about kind of how AI is coming to this field and what we should be thinking about?
AI and genetics are married, and there's no way to separate them. The wedding took place in 1990 at the beginning of the Human Genome Initiative, and they didn't know in 1990 just exactly how they were going to map the human genome, but the computer technology came in, and by the year 2000, 2001, they had it. And so the field of bioinformatics became popular, and everything accelerated after the development of CRISPR gene editing, maybe a dozen years or so ago, which is a very simple, that's what scientists tell me, I've never, a very simple process for editing the genome. And you were asking, Gilad, about issues. When I'm around geneticists who are using CRISPR gene editing and they can do marvels with changing the human genome, it's interesting, all by themselves, they have one strong moral imperative, and that is genetic therapy, yes. Germline modification, no. They do not want to alter the genome of an unborn baby who might carry that on to children, grandchildren, and future generations. And their argument is there may be unknown side effects, and we would not want and let something irreversible into the environment. So I applaud the scientists. They do have high moral standards even before the ethicist gets to have a cup of coffee with them.
That is very promising. And thank you for sharing that. So let's just jump straight into some of the key topics that we wanted to talk about today. And of course, gene editing is one of those. Braden, maybe you can kick us off here. Just help us define at a high level, what is gene editing? How widespread is this in an actual practice in the world today? And then, of course, begin to tell us, how does AI come into that whole conversation?
Broadly speaking, gene editing is finding technological ways to either remove, insert, or change the actual details, that the quote-unquote text that we find in the genes, in our DNA. And some of that has been very rudimentary. In my biology classes in college, we actually used what they call restriction enzymes, which would create breaks of DNA at palindromic sequences. So you had sequences that could be read the same way forwards and backwards. This enzyme that we find from bacteria, to cut DNA at that point. And then the idea would be to try and introduce another sequence of DNA into that. So Ted talks about CRISPR being easier. The analogy that I've heard people say is we're sort of now we're working with a scalpel, whereas before maybe we're working with like a chainsaw. So the idea is that things are supposed to be a little more precise. But unfortunately, the first use of this in humans occurred in China and in some very unethical ways. And even then, there was only about 30% penetrance in terms of being able to actually bring about the change that they wanted. And so I would say it's not terribly widespread, although we are at the point where we are entering human trials for very specific kinds of treatments. But I imagine that number is only going to grow, in the near future.
My next question was going to be, how close are we? And you already answered that question. I mean, human trials, and I have to say that my intuition, hanging out with a lot of AI folk building models and whatever, is that the speed is only going to accelerate. And Sarah Jo, how do we begin to think about this from an ethical perspective? When is it ethical to do this? And then obviously, if you can draw on any of your faith or philosophical traditions, that would maybe help us think about that.
Well, I think context is important. So I think one of the things that's difficult about making a sweeping claim about this is that meeting people where they are, meeting cultures where they are, and answering these questions would be one thing to consider. However, I think one of the biggest worries, the large scale worries that I have, is that when we're remaking or editing, what kind of image do we have of what it means to be human in our minds? And is that image fair to push on everyone else, right? What do we worry about humans becoming, and what do we hope humans become? And we have a lot of biases that are both conscious and unconscious. And if we don't sort of bring those to the surface and have those kind of conversations, I don't think we can really direct these is ought question, the ought question of what we ought to do in particulars. So yeah, I think it would be wrong to act too quickly, but it's hard sometimes, I think, with any of these questions in technology ethics. It feels like we're kind of just along for the ride, that technology is moving in one direction and we just kind of have to clean up after it or something. But I would invite the slowing down and reflect on, like, well, what does it mean to be human? What do we want the human to be in the future? Because we already have some ideas about that, I think, from our different faith traditions. I think they often inform that vision.
Yeah, absolutely. And Ted, what about you? How do you think about this from your faith tradition? When is this ethical or unethical, or how should we consider this?
Well, what Braden and Sarah Jo have touched on that people in this field think a lot about, and that is, what does it mean to be human? Could we, by changing the human genome, produce a post-human? I don't think scientifically people take that seriously. Most of the actual experimentation currently is for therapeutic purpose. And I think that virtue ethicists, and I don't know, Sarah Jo, if we can get this out of Hans Jonas or not, like Aristotle's notion of eudaimonia and human flourishing, and we know that if you're healthy, you're more likely to flourish than if you're unhealthy. So right now, I'm not too worried about where the field at large is going. But yes, the potential for getting into the human genome and changing genes for some malicious purpose, making the perfect soldier who's a perfect killer, and these kinds of scenarios do worry ethicists, and they have to work. And this was implied in your question: is there really an essence to human life? I'm a Lutheran, and we believe in original sin, and we believe that human life can be improved over time. I don't believe that genetic manipulation will eliminate original sin. I don't think there's a gene for virtue. Oh, yes, there are certainly biological dispositions that tend to give us the option of a more virtuous life, to be sure. But I'm going to want to hear Sarah Jo at some point connect Hans Jonas with this question, because I am so impressed with Jonas. He almost makes me want to be a naturalist. That is, that nature herself teaches us that life needs to succeed and stay alive. And so I'm hoping that at some point, Sarah Jo, you'll extrapolate a little bit on Jonas here in terms of telling us what should the future of humanity look like.
And Sarah Jo, as you prepare for answer that very simple question you were just posed there, I wanted to add a Jewish perspective to that as well. So in Judaism, we have a concept called pikuach nefesh, which is preserving the soul or protecting the soul. And I've heard a lot of people describe this and say, as Jews, we're supposed to live with the commandments. And live is a key word of that sentence. If you are no longer living, you can't live with the commandments. And thus in Judaism, you know, there's this big command, kind of like you're talking about, to protect human life and to protect human dignity. And that comes above keeping the Shabbat, which is always the easy example of like, can you get in the car to go to the hospital on Shabbat? Well, of course you can, if it's life-threatening. And if anything, it's actually the commandment to get in the car and go protect the person's life. So I really like that concept that you posed there of like, how do we live with this stuff and really continuing to live is a core element there. Sarah Jo, how do you want to add that? And then we'll get Braden in this as well.
I want to get a quickie in there. The issue isn't just protecting life, it's remaking it, redesigning it. So can your Jewish roots give us any guidance there? You don't need to answer it right now. I think Sarah Jo and Braden have things to say.
I wanted to touch upon two distinctions I think Ted is making that for people who are maybe not as familiar with some of this material might find helpful to pull apart a little bit. So Ted's used the word germline and he's also used the word therapeutic. And so those are really dealing with two different things. So first we have the distinction between what we call somatic versus germline modification. So let's say that you're diabetic and your pancreas no longer makes, the islet cells in your pancreas no longer make insulin. If there was a way that we can modify the genes in your pancreas to then create insulin again, that would be a somatic change. That is cells, non-reproductive cells in your body. And that change would only occur in your lifetime. And when you pass away, that change is no longer out there. If you have children, that is also not being affected. Germline modification is changing the genes that are in the germline. So the egg and the sperm cells, which those changes would get passed on to future generations. And so that's why when Ted says that scientists seem to be in favor of, or seem to be against germline modification, it's that permanency there that somatic changes would not necessarily bring about. And then lots of people argue about whether or not the distinction between therapeutic and enhancement exists or if it's helpful, but it is one that's been around for a long time. You know, I'm most familiar with it from George W. Bush's President's Council on Bioethics. And I think a lot of religious traditions have picked up on it, that things that are therapeutic, things that can help improve health, yes. Things that would exceed our capacities, introduce new capacities, enhancements, no. But the question for me is, well, if we're on a bell curve of height and you're giving somebody human growth hormone, at what point would you stop on that bell curve to say this is therapeutic and that any improvement to our health in some way is an enhancement of life? And so, you know, for a lot of theologians, philosophers, that distinction breaks down, but it's one that is still very prevalent in the field and discussion. So I just wanted to provide some more context there.
Thank you. That was amazing. And Sarah Jo,
I feel like that was incredibly precise and really getting us into the technology and the specifics. And I'm going to go like way broad philosophical. So sorry. But two things. One, of course, and this is kind of obvious, but like, what is life, right? The question of what is life. And I think Jonas reminds us that life itself is valuable, but human life has something very distinct about it. Morals, right? Like we actually care. Like we actually can bring about things that help others, right? That we have this external relation with others. And this freedom, right? And our freedom is higher than other organisms. So on the one hand, I think that helps us a little bit in defining human life versus other life. But on the other side of things, I think that the life, non-life, the animal, the human divides, those kind of the rhetoric of those things often complicate things when we get to things like AI, because we've often said that humans are intelligent and all these different things, when now AI seems to look like that. And now we're like, oh, but we're living, we're biological. And now we're like, oh, we're like the animals. But before we're like, we're not like the animals. And Yoda says this too. But I think that he tries to find value in freedom and necessity. We'll never just be purely free. We can only have freedom because of necessity. And I think that more broadly relates to the idea that like technology always promises this like flow that will just kind of keep moving in a direction, as I mentioned, but also in a positive way that it'll be easier, but we always meet resistance. And I think it's getting rid of the resistance and trying to get rid of the resistance that is where we lose our humanity in a lot of ways.
Guys, these are some amazing topics. Now, I want to bring straight on transhumanism, and I wonder if there's other terms that we should be using that are better than that. And since Braden has been our definer so far today, we're going to put Braden back in the hot seat. So help us understand, what even is the concept of transhumanism?
Sure. So when I'm explaining that to people that are relatively new or have questions about what that means, I make two sort of distinctions. I first say, have you ever wanted to have magical powers? Did you ever, you know, put a towel around your neck as a kid and pretend you were a superhero, then I would say
Love that.
you have experienced the transhumanist impulse. It's this desire to transcend or exceed what it means to be human. So there's that general feeling that we might have in a variety of contexts that, especially when Sergio was saying about popular culture, I love bringing in things like science fiction and that into the classroom because I think it's something that people can relate to. So that's why I start there. And then I say that transhumanism is also a non-monolithic movement that really wants to say evolution has been undirected. We can argue about evolution and teleology for a long time if we want to and purpose, but the idea being that evolution has been this random process. Now we have the tools in which we can actually make intentional choices about what it means to be human. And we're going to do that to improve what it means to be human. And there are some that only want to increase our current capacities. There are others that maybe want to introduce new capacities or abilities. And then there are others who, like Ted said, want to create one or more post-human species, moving beyond Homo sapiens sapien to Homo sapiens something else.
Yeah, and how do we think about that? Where's that line? I know it's not a bright line in the sand where we are no longer Homo sapien or whatever, but like, how should we think about that? Is that IQ at a different order of magnitude than we have now? Is it some sort of physical capability? Like, maybe it's too hard of a question to even answer, but how should we think about that line?
Well, that's actually where my current research is. And one of my doctoral students is teaching a class, introductory class on science and religion. And we got into this debate a little bit in our last class. And for me, the easy line is if we take a definition of species as being reproductively compatible populations. So if we're actually able to do what people like Ray Kurzweil say, and we're able to upload our consciousness into a digital substrate, then for me, that is a very clear line that that is no longer Homo sapiens sapien. We can't reproduce with those entities. Now, beyond that, I think is where the question gets more nebulous. And that's where I'm trying to bring virtue theory into that question and say, at what point would enough change have happened that Ted mentioned eudaimonia, this idea of flourishing, that flourishing is distinct for us as it is for an acorn. The purpose of an acorn, the flourishing of an acorn is to become an oak tree. And so at what point have we changed our nature sufficiently that our end is different enough that there's a different understanding of flourishing? And the theological component for that is, how does that work in terms of a supernatural end? So Aquinas might say, I'm taking Aristotle's end as natural and that's all good, but then we also have a spiritual end of humanity. And could that apply to AI? Could AI have the theological virtues of God decided to infuse AI with the theological virtues? But we're opening a whole nother can of worms, so I'll let the conversation move on.
No, that's amazing. We're going to be heading on the same question as kind of how should we be thinking about transhumanism? But I just love what you had to say there, and it really connects, like I referenced earlier, a conversation we had about consciousness and the question of is consciousness as we humans have it uniquely biological, or is it possible to upload our consciousness to some other kind of substrate? And of course, we don't know the answer, but it was a really interesting question. So, Ted, join us on this topic.
Well, right here, if you compare the transhumanist to the Christian, they have different anthropologies. The transhumanist anthropology is all oriented towards intelligence. The summum bonum is higher intelligence. The Christian's going to say, oh no, being a good, loving person, that's worth more. So let me tell you a little fundamental story. About 20 some years ago, we had a conference at Stanford with these young bucks with their new PhDs in computer science. And it was on the question of the future of genetics and computer science. They used the word artificial intelligence a little bit, but they were talking about super intelligence, crossing the line from where we are now to a higher level of intelligence. Ray Kurzweil would call that the singularity. Well, in the group was Nick Bostrom from Oxford. So he says, let's imagine now that we have a microcomputer that we surgically put in the person's brain. Oh, yeah, everybody kind of liked that, took a sip of coffee. Now, this microcomputer has all the information of Encyclopedia Britannica. He didn't mention Wikipedia, but so now in his theory, your and my mind has access immediately in our thought processes to everything in the encyclopedia. Now, here's what I think is an enormous fallacy. They think that if you have access to more information, you'll have a leap into greater intelligence, which I think is fallacious. But here, the conversation went on, and I love the what happened then. Then Bostrom says, well, let's imagine now that, you know, your memory in this implanted computer will go out of date, right? So you got to pump in new information every week. How are we going to do that? Well, we'll have a satellite that beams down an update. So your mind now is receiving updates of your information regularly. Okay, so everybody kind of liked that. And then Bostrom says, well, let's ask who's in charge of the satellite. What happens if a tyrant gets in charge of the satellite and then sends you propaganda right into your brain? Well, then I finally said something. I can think of something worse. I can think of them pumping advertising right into my brain. I can never escape it. Be that as it may, they're looking forward to a post-human whose level of intelligence will be greater than yours and mine. And one form of it is your and my mind having greater information processing that leaps to higher levels of intelligence. It's not a very good theory, in my opinion, but it has been one that the transhumanists have relied on.
And then, Sarah Jo, bringing into this as well, is this inevitable? I mean, is this the type of thing where we all want the best for our kids? So even with the best intent, you know, I do a little thing for my kid and they do a little thing for their kid. And we're just going down the slippery slope. And should we try to stop it if possible? Or do you think this is kind of an okay slope for us to go down?
Are we talking about like moving towards transhumanism?
Yeah. And again, I'm not talking about people who want to create killer robots or things that we can probably all agree are not desirable in the world. I'm talking about the inevitable, like we all love our kids. We all want just slightly better for our kids.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's a great question in ethics, right? So maybe we don't know everything. We can't have like a concrete answer, but what kind of life would you love for your kids? Doesn't Aristotle say that? I don't know. But I have a few thoughts about the transhumanism stuff that I want to pick up on.
Please.
One, I wanted to mention, Braden had mentioned that transhumanism is just like one thing. I think it's important that Nick Bostrom and others represent one version of transhumanism, but I've heard and I've read about more grassroots ideas about transhumanism. And I think that there is a sort of appreciation for humanity and developing human capacities that reflects a real humanism. And I wanna like acknowledge that. On the other side of things, you know, if it's the question of we ought to develop these technology in direction so that we can advance humanity, I mean, I wish it was the case that this would be fair and just and that everyone would get the opportunity to develop these capacities. But we all know that even when it comes to healthcare, like only a certain few get to take advantage of these wonderful technologies. So just to sort of recognize that. But I also think that we've been kind of talking a little bit about like the transmission of things and understanding what it means to be human by looking at our biology. But, and this is where I want to go back to the question of like faith or just the theological traditions of it, because I think from a theological standpoint, what it means to be human doesn't just come from the scientific or the biological, even though it doesn't have to be in conflict with theological perspective. I think that revelation, right, like reveals something about what humans are supposed to be. And if that's the case, then we don't have to just look at biology. So I am glad we reference Aquinas. You know, I teach at Yale University, so the Catholic thought is good. But also, let me just say that that I also think from the standpoint of a more, again, humanist perspective, that like the appreciation of humanity doesn't just come from what we will become, but what we have been, right? So the past, looking at the past of the greatness of humanity. And I think, again, Jonas, the image of man we've inherited, or humans, I should say humans. I know he meant humans, but he says man because it's more eloquent. But I think this, the idea of the image of cultivating a respect for humanity can't just come from one place, but looking at the past as well as where we are headed.
Absolutely. And I love that you said that, because of course, the whole point of AI and faith and really what drew me to this organization is the belief that we can learn a lot from our faith traditions, from our philosophical traditions, that is completely relevant for the crazy new world we're in. Now, before I begin to try to land this plane, I wanted to bring Braden and Ted one more time to this conversation. When I was preparing for this, I was talking to a friend of mine who's quite devout, and she made the point that, you know, we were made in God's image, and that God is at the core a creator. I mean, that's the main thing we know about God, is that God is a creator. And she made the point that maybe all these things we're doing, gene editing with transhumanism, we didn't really get to talk about human AI hybrids, which is a topic people are spending a lot of time thinking about. Maybe that's exactly what we're supposed to be doing and exactly what God and faith has intended us to do. And I'm wondering if you have any thoughts on that, if it's reasonable to say that all these abilities we're developing are really coming directly from God's will. Any other thoughts around kind of the ethics of transhumanism as we try to land the plane? We'll have Ted go first and we'll have Braden come in.
Well, as Sergio made the point, there are a variety of different kinds of transhumanists, and those that I have met tend to have high ethical standards, which is something I appreciate very much. When we talk about the image of God in us, do you want to go the conservative route and say, oh, it was built in the origin, and we ought not to mess it up by screwing up our human genome? Or St. Paul in the New Testament looks forward to becoming more Christ-like. And so the image of God really is eschatological. It's the kingdom of God. It's the perfect society ruled by justice and compassion. Well, there is a group called the Christian Transhumanist Association, and these are nice people. And they are looking for technology to help us to become better people. So there are these various wings. I think the most important criticism of the transhumanists is they're utopians. And by the way, I like utopianism, but they think that technology alone is going to get us there. But it takes a distinctively human transformation for any utopia to actually provide flourishing, human flourishing.
Yeah, absolutely. And Braden?
I think I might build right on that last point that Ted made, and that in my own work I use a lot of Reinhold Niebuhr, and I think that's in part because Niebuhr saw the attractiveness of the social gospel movement, but recognized that the bad things that humans do prevents that from actually being able to be achieved in this life. And so we need to take the realities of human sin seriously. And Sergio is completely right to bring up these concerns about who's going to have access, or whose understanding of what it means to be a better human. We've seen lots of examples of how that plays out. And unfortunately, a lot of the people that are getting attention for espousing these ideas tend to be white computer scientists, men in Silicon Valley who have particular standing in society that they want to maintain for as long as they can, with radical life extension or perhaps even immortality in some sort of sense. So theologically, I think there are critiques to that, that a lot of religious traditions would say that kind of life interrupts the spiritual cycle of existence. So for Christians, if we were to live forever, we would never get the beatific vision. And so what does that say about us then? Or even in a faith that believes in reincarnation, then how do you ever take the lessons that you've learned and apply that to transforming your own existence? So I think for me, the image of God, for being two verses in the Bible, has gotten a lot of attention, and theologians have come up with all sorts of ways to classify it. But Phil Hefner's created co-creator, I think, can do a lot of work. But the idea is it's the created that's a part of it. I wish I could remember who told the joke, but there was a UC Berkeley just put on a conference, oh, just over a week ago now. And somebody was telling a joke where God was talking with a scientist about creating life. And God reaches down into the dirt and creates a human. And then the scientist then starts to touch the dirt, and God says, hey, get your own dirt. And that's, for me, I think that's explaining this idea of created co-creator. There's sort of an analogy that I've used in an article where, are we just rearranging the Lego blocks that are there because that's what created co-creator sounds like? Or are we actually being able to create the blocks that could then be incorporated into the blocks that already exist? And I don't think I'm there yet, but I think that things like artificial intelligence, if we were to actually able create something that could be sentient or could be self-conscious, that's a level of creation that I don't think that we have interacted with yet before. And so the question then becomes also, would that be made in the image of humanity, the image of God, or both? And how do we want to define the image of humanity, other than I think moral ambiguity has to be a part of that.
I just want to add one thing here. I think that the theological concept of idolatry it's been on my mind a lot lately for lots of reasons. But I think that we've talked about the image of what it means to be human, the image of man, the image of the human being. But yeah, like, when does it become a point where technology becomes our idol? When we ourselves, like the image of what we think we should be, becomes an idol? There's so many different ways to think about idolatry, but I think that that's why it's so useful in these kind of conversations, because it really is that we tend to worship things and then not need something else, whether that's God or whatever. But this reaching out and needing something beyond us seems important. And if it's just what we are going to create in the world and then use that to make us better, I don't know if that's going to work. That freedom necessity thing is always there.
That's an important point. And Pope Francis, both Pope Francis and Leo the 14th are very interested in AI development. But Pope Francis did make your point, Sarah Jo, that it's easy for us to fall into the habit of trusting technology to solve all problems, and it can't. And that idol is eventually going to crumble. And he's warning us not to idolize any technology, but AI in particular.
Absolutely. I speak at a lot of events, and I would say in a world of ubiquitous AI, it's the human connection and the human relationship that's going to be the most meaningful and valuable thing. And that's absolutely what I hope all of us focus on. Now, we're almost out of time, but I do want to ask one question to each of you. It's a little bit more lower to the ground. You know, I'm lucky to spend some time with entrepreneurs in the human biology and the medical space. So I'm going to ask a different question to each of you. But of course, if you want, you can always piggyback. So Sarah Jo, starting with you, because you talked about access already, and I think this is something that's really important. So I was grappling with the question of, is it ethical for startups that are doing something in medical space with AI, with new technology, to begin to test those in poorer countries? And I could kind of make both sides of the argument. I'm wondering kind of where your ethical head and learning is at. You know, on one hand, I could argue that it makes no sense to go to somewhere less wealthy than you and testing something new on them. That's something that, like, just sounds awful to begin with. But on the other hand, in the United States, a lot of more people have access to doctors than maybe in some other countries where they don't have access. And this thing might actually have more of a positive impact on the ground. So how do you think about the ethical kind of balancing act of where we should deploy these new technologies, where there might be more need, where there might be more money? How do you think about that?
So just to be clear, the use of these technologies being medical, like assistant, like where they don't have doctors, is that,
exactly.
Is that what
you mean? Robotic surgery is something specifically that we have some startups here in Seattle where I live, where the robots haven't been tested. So it feels really bad to go test them in a poor country, but there are probably fewer surgeons in that country as well, right? These are really hard questions.
Yeah. Well, there's a lot of, I have more concerns than I have like confidence in this being a good idea.
Yeah.
One is, I think there's a lot of like little, like smaller things we could do to help them if that's what our concern was. We might be just trying to get around certain regulations by going to other countries. That's another concern I would have.
Yeah.
Also, I think there could be some good out that would come out of it, certainly, but I guess I would question the motives mostly. And I wish that I could believe it. I think it'd be better just to send doctors, like actual human doctors, to just talk to people about how they're feeling.
Right.
Totally. Braden?
Yeah, I think this is a really great place to bring up something that I've been wanting to, but I haven't found the right time to talk about it. That I think that when we talk about things like gene editing, we make it sound like we know exactly what we're doing and we can bring about this exact change. And we still don't fully understand what genes do and the interplay between genes. And so even in my own work, when I've looked at moral enhancement and what genes could we actually affect that would make a difference, it's very hard to find reliable information. And even then, if we want to talk about like helping something like alcoholism, which is maybe 50% genetic, that means there's 50% that isn't. And so should these startups be spending money on robot surgeons, or should they be spending money on things that could actually really help? So that's part of the issue with allocation too, is we have a finite amount of funds to be used in different types of medical research. And would it be better to just, like Sarah Jo said, send doctors instead of trying to develop a new app that could help them, you know, identify symptoms with a smartphone? I think there's a broader question there too, in the kinds of projects that we would even be conceiving about going about. And is there a more efficient way? I hate to bring efficiency into it, but is there a more financially efficient way to bring about the kinds of change that we want?
Yeah, absolutely. Okay, another question to you, Braden. Loneliness is a problem that we have all over the world. And I always like to use Japan as an example, even though I don't mean to pick on them, where the age pyramid's upside down. So it was like to say if every grandchild was a doting grandchild, there would still not be enough grandchildren to visit all the grandparents. How do you feel about AI companions? You know, we see a lot of AI, like robot pets is something that's becoming kind of popular. How do we think about kind of the ethical trade-offs of introducing non-human, natural animal companions for people?
Yeah, I think that is a hornet's nest. it's funny because I've actually had a discussion with my dad My mother passed away about 4 years ago now, and he sort of talks about if he didn't have to travel back and forth between Pennsylvania and Florida, that it might be nice to have an animal in the house again. But he can't take care of an animal. And so he's like, if there was an AI cat that could act like a cat and felt like a cat, he's like, I would love that. But right now it seems like I either get a plush doll or I get a completely robotic thing that might be able to mimic an animal, but he's like, neither of those are what I'm looking for. That's a very anecdotal kind of answer. But then if you take that to the next level and say, well, okay, not animal, but like an actual companion then for people, going back to caretakers, like I was talking about, I think until we have something that is actually able to genuinely interact and genuinely have a sense of self, it's problematic. And I would say it's not just grandparents. Unfortunately, I think that kind of companionship is another thing. We talked about making decisions that have an impact on future generations. Well, we saw that with gender selection, and that now we have populations where there are far more men than women, and pretty much no chances of a large percentage of people to ever have a marriage. And so I think AI is also going to be a place in which that becomes a quote unquote potential solution. And for me, I guess the question is that imperfect solution better than the lack of? And I don't have a good answer, because I genuinely think that trying to form a relationship with something that's incapable of having a relationship is not healthy. And yet we know the health statistics that come with things like touch starvation and not being able to actually have meaningful connection. And at some point, I think you have to start thinking, how do we best try to mitigate these things, even if we can't solve them? And I don't have a good answer other than I want to pump the brakes for now.
And the most important point is we all need to be thinking about these things meaningfully and deeply, because the implications are many. And Ted, you're going to get the last one. So we briefly touched on AI human hybrids. And of course, in Silicon Valley, there's lots of people excited about different chips that we might put in our brains that would give us AI powers. Is that a good idea, bad idea? And what are some of the ethical things we should be
Well, at
considering?
Stanford Medical School, they're going for therapy. That is to say, can these chips in the brain help a person with dementia or something? So that medical motive, I mean, I can only applaud, and I hope that they are successful. Again, I think the transhumanist theory that from information you can leap to intelligence is fallacious. They ought not to try that. With regard to the question you had raised a moment ago, I read the summary of a Pew Foundation survey in which they concluded that the vast majority of people are happy to have AI do calculations, but very few want AI to contribute to deeply personal things or to religious things. So, I love my dog a whole lot more than my computer screen.
Me too. And I like
Absolutely.
my computer a lot, but I really love my
That's exactly right. And Ted, what you said reminds me of many of our audience know that I started a company called UChip many years ago that was the first AI trip planning company. And one of the things that we learned was that no matter how great the algorithmic optimization of the itinerary was, there's things people don't want from AI. And one of those is kind of the serendipitous discovery, which is really one of the most enjoyable parts of travel. But of course, what they want the AI for is to optimize geographies and not stuck in traffic all day. Figuring out that balance, I think, is a challenge that all of us in society have to do as we roll AI, as we just talked about, into every element of our existence in human life. I just want to say that it has been a real pleasure and a real honor to have all three of you on the podcast. Before I let you go, we do have a lightning round question. I promise they're all easy, not like the things I've been putting you through. You've got about 15 seconds apiece. Sarah Jo, you're going to go first. And the first question is, what is one of your favorite personal use cases for AI?
I think it's really useful for writing. I know that's horrible as an educator to say that, but I think that the dialogue that you could have with AI when you're feeling a little insecure about what you're saying, especially when you can get it to customize and train on your own work, I think it's really, really useful. And I think there's a lot of problems with it, but I really do feel like it's helpful for getting over writing hurdles.
Outstanding, Braden.
Well, I guess, can you clarify exactly what you mean? Because I think in the classroom, I would say copyright issues to me jumps out as a clear case study that I think there's lots of really interesting work that has to be done. But I'm not sure if you're using the word in that term.
No, that's perfect. And Ted, what about you? What do you like to do with AI?
I love cartoons, but I don't draw very well, so I go to Dolly and I make cartoons that communicate all kinds of things that I couldn't have drawn, so I love it.
I love that. My daughter and I use it to co-write children's books with me, her, and the
Oh.
AI. Amazing. Okay, Ted, you're going to go first on this next one. What are not enough people talking about when it comes to artificial intelligence?
I don't think that they're talking enough about the mistake in attributing too much value to intelligence, which is extremely valuable. But again, what makes life the way God wants it is that we love one another. And I'd like to have that discussed a little more frequently.
Absolutely. And Braden?
Yeah, I would say this has come up with the grant that we had through the Templeton Foundation looking at AI and virtue, but the environmental impact of all the aspects that come with AI, from data
Oh my,
centers,
that's
water,
amazing.
noise, electricity, all those things.
Yeah, the environment comes up all the time when I ask people this question. And Sarah Jo, what are not enough people talking about?
I think just how they're trained. I mean, I know that it comes up a lot, but I think that every time that what we can do with it, I think we remind ourselves how they're trained and like the literacy that is required to learn about that so that you can know their limits just based on where they're originating from. I think that would be good.
I completely agree. And especially in circles like ours, remembering that AI is not neutral. It was trained by someone to do something. And we have to remember that. And then last question, Brandon, you're going to go first. Would you personally want access to an AI faith leader, a priest or a pastor?
The curious side of me says, access, sure. I think it'd be interesting to talk to, but I'm not sure that I actually want spiritual guidance from. So maybe a cheat answer, but that's, I think it's worth exploring, and people have asked questions about whether or not you can utilize, AI in that way. And I think that Sarah Jo had mentioned revelation. This is something I've been struggling with. I haven't had the time to really dig at, but Bob Russell sort of talks about God being able to act in the indeterminacy that is foundational to nature. And if I think if there's a level of indeterminacy in something like generative AI, then it might actually be possible to have genuine revelation through it. But I would need to really study the science more and talk to computer scientists to see whether that's even feasible.
Outstanding. Sarah Jo, would you want access to a priest or a rabbi or some religious leader?
Well, I think it's interesting to think about finding God in all things and like not excluding something. So I think Braden's point was great, but I think, yeah, I could accidentally reveal something to me about myself or about the world that could inspire thought and exploration. So I wouldn't be opposed to it. I want to know where it came from and how it was trained.
Absolutely. And Ted?
A teacher, yes. Some Buddhists in East Asia have the Buddha bot. You
Yep.
punch a button and you get a teaching. A pastor, no. I think faith in God is like a disease, it's contagious. And so the pastor's got to have that disease. And so that has to be personal for me.
Absolutely. Well, thank you guys so much for joining us. This truly has been an incredible conversation. And of course, thank you to all of you and our AI and faith community for joining us again. We can't wait to have you with us next time. Stay tuned to listen to more conversations and interviews with experts from around the world. In the meantime, follow and rate our podcast on your favorite podcast platform and share it with your friends so they can join this important conversation. Don't forget to also follow us on social media. We are on LinkedIn, X, and Blue Sky. Thank you for joining us.